And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is December 2nd, 336th day of the year, 337th in leap years. 29 days remain till the end of the year. On this date in history, in 1244, Pope Innocent IV arrives at Lyon for the First Council of Lyon. 1409, University of Leipzig opens. 1697, St. Paul's Cathedral is consecrated in London. 1763, dedication of the Touro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island. First synagogue in what will become the United States. In 1766, Swedish Parliament approves the Swedish Freedom of the Press Act and implements it as a ground law, being the first in the world with freedom of speech. We had it here until this recent election. Try to say something that's not politically correct on Facebook or Twitter, and they'll block you in a Mississippi minute. 1804, at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, and Napoleon Bonaparte crowns himself Emperor of the French. 1805, War of the Third Coalition, Battle of Austerlitz. French troops under Napoleon decisively defeat a joint Russian-Austrian force. The 1823, the Monroe Doctrine. It was in a State of the Union message. President Monroe proclaimed American neutrality in future European conflicts and warned European powers not to interfere in the Americas. So in spite of what we're told in school, it was not a law. It was a presidential proclamation. 1845, Manifest Destiny. In a State of the Union message, President James K. Polk proposes the United States should aggressively expand to the West. 1848, Franz Joseph I becomes Emperor of Austria. 1851, French President Louis Napoleon Bonaparte overthrows the Second Republic. 1852, Louis Napoleon Bonaparte becomes Emperor of the French as Napoleon III. 1859, militant abolitionist leader John Brown is hung for his October 16th raid on Harper's Ferry in West Virginia. He raided Harper's Ferry, which was a big arsenal. He thought that slaves and other anti-government types would flock to his banner. He could arm them from the arsenal, and they would proceed to overthrow the government. Didn't work out that way. In fact, Robert E. Lee was in command of the troops that brought him down. 1865, Alabama ratifies the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, followed by North Carolina, then Georgia. 13th Amendment said the slaves were legally free. 1867, at Tremont Temple in Boston, British author Charles Dickens gives his first public reading in the United States. 1899, Philippine War. Battle of Tirad Pass, termed the Filipino Thermopylae, is fought. 1908, Puyi becomes emperor of China at the age of 2. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, he was the last emperor. 1917, World War I, Russia and the Central Powers sign an armistice at Brest-Litovsk, and peace talks lead to the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk begins. 1927, following 19 years of Ford Model T production, Ford Motor Company unveils the Ford Model A as its new automobile. 1930, Great Depression. In a State of the Union message, President Herbert Hoover proposes a $150 million public works program to help generate jobs and stimulate the economy. 1939, LaGuardia Airport opens in New York City, named after Fiorello LaGuardia. 1942, World War II. During the Manhattan Project, a team led by Enrico Fermi initiates the first artificial self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction. 1943, World War II. A Luftwaffe bombing raid on the harbor of Bari, Italy, sinks numerous cargo and transport ships, including the American SS John Harvey, which is carrying a stockpile of World War I era mustard gas. 1947, Jerusalem riots. Riots break out in Jerusalem in response to the United Nations partition plan for Palestine. 1949, Convention for the Suppression of the Traffic in Persons of the Exploitation of the Prostitution of Others is adopted. And even though it's the title itself is a mouthful, it didn't accomplish a great deal. 1950, Korean War. Battle of the Chongshan River ends with a decisive Chinese victory. UN forces are completely expelled from North Korea. UN forces had won the war up until the involvement of China, and they just had so many people to throw at the UN troops. 1954, Cold War. United States Senate votes 65-22 to censor Joseph McCarthy for conduct that tends to bring the Senate into dishonor and disrepute. He was on his horse about hidden communist in the movies. 1954. The Sino-American Mutual Defense Treaty between the U.S. and Taiwan is signed in Washington, D.C. 1956, the Granma reaches the shores of Cuba's Orient Province. Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and 80 other members of the 26th of July movement disembarked to initiate the Cuban Revolution. Nobody knew at the time that he was in bed with the Russians. 1962, Vietnam War. 1962, at the request of President Kennedy, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield becomes the first American official to comment adversely on the war's progress. 1970, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency begins operations. 1971, Abu Dhabi, Ajman, Fujairah, Sharjah and Dubai and Umm al-Quwan formed the United Arab Emirates. 1975, Laotian Civil War. The Pathet Lao seizes the Laotian capital of Vientiane, forces the abdication of King Sisavang Vatthana, and proclaimed the Lao People's Democratic Republic. When they start throwing words like Democratic Republic around, you know that they are communist sympathizers. 1976, Fidel Castro becomes president of Cuba, replaces Osvaldo Dorticos Torrado. 1980, Salvadoran Civil War. Four American missionaries are raped, murdered by a death squad. 1982, at the University of Utah, Barney Clark becomes the first person to get a permanent artificial heart. 1988, Benazir Bhutto is sworn in as Prime Minister of Pakistan, becomes the first woman to head the government of an Islam-dominated state. 1989, the peace agreement of Hat Yai is signed and ratified by the Malayan Communist Party and the governments of Malaysia and Thailand, ending the war, the two-decade-long communist insurgency in Malaysia. 1991, Canada and Poland become the first nations to recognize independence of Ukraine from the Soviet Union. 1993, Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar is shot and killed in Medellin. Also in 93, Space Shuttle Program, the STS-61. NASA launches the Space Shuttle Endeavour on a mission to repair the Hubble Space Telescope. 1999, the UK devolves political power in Northern Ireland to the Northern Ireland Executive following the Good Friday Agreement. 2001, Enron files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. 2015, San Bernardino attack. Syed, Izwan, Farouk, and Tashfeen Malik kill 14 and wound 22 at the Inland Regional Center in San Bernardino, California. 2016, 36 people die in a fire in a converted Oakland, California warehouse serving as an artist collective. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. The, holidays and observances. On this date, it's Armed Forces Day in Cuba. Christian feast days. Avitus of Ruin. Bibiana. Channing Moore Williams and Anglican Church. Chromatius. Habakkuk in the Eastern Orthodox Church. Nonnus. International Day for the Abolition of Slavery, United Nations. Lao National Day. And in the United Arab Emirates, National Day as well. Let's see what else we got. Okay. 1929, the first skull of Peking Man found in the caves of Zhukudian, 50 kilometers outside of Peking, China. Skull's about 750,000 years old. Fred Astaire's first film is released. It's called The Dancing Lady. Famous birthdays, George Seurat, Gianni Versace, Monica Seles, Britney Spears, she's all of 39, and Aaron Rodgers. The first Model A Ford sold for $385, which was considered an unheard-of sum at the time. 1886, the 26th U.S. President, Theodore Roosevelt, who was 28 at the time, married his second wife, Edith Kermit Carroll, in London. 1947, Hernan Cortez in 1547. The Marquis de Sade in 1814. John Brown, 1859. In fact, he was hung. Desi Arnaz in 1986. Aaron Copland in 1990, and Pablo Escobar in 1993. Okay, see what else we have, if anything. Okay, in 1170, Thomas Becket, Archbishop of Canterbury, returned to Canterbury from France. 1515, Gonzalo de Cordoba, the Spanish general, strategist, and viceroy of Naples, dies. 1776, George Washington's army began retreating across the Delaware River from New Jersey into Pennsylvania. 1777, British officers under General Howe met in the Philadelphia home of Lydia Darragh to discuss plans to attack American forces. Just prior to Washington's move to Valley Forge, Ms. Darragh listened in on the plans and sent word to Washington of the impending attack. 1816, the first savings bank in the United States, the Philadelphia Savings Fund Society, opened for business. In 1837, Dr. Joseph Bell, a British physician, was born. Many believe he's the prototype of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's detective Sherlock Holmes. Let's see. And we're talking about John Brown, who was hung in 1859. In October of 1858, he had raided the and captured the Harper's Ferry arsenal. He was convicted and executed at Charlestown for treason against the state of Virginia after his raid. Six of his men were later convicted and hung. 1910, Oswald Garrison Villard authored an account on Brown's life. In 1863, Charles Ringling, one of the seven Ringling brothers of circus fame, was born. Of the seven, five were involved in the founding of the Ringling Brothers Circus. Two other Ringling brothers never associated with the circus, which began as a wagon show in 1884. 1907, they bought the Barnum and Bailey Circus, and after 1918, called their circus the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey combined shows. 1967, John Ringling's son, John Ringling North, sold the circus to non-family members. Let's see. In 1892, Jay Gould, an American financier, died. At that time, his wealth was estimated to be $72 million, which was an unheard-of sum for the period. In 1900, John Hossack, an Iowa farmer and a prosperous citizen of Warren County, was killed in his bed from two blows with an axe. His wife was accused of the murder. But during that time frame, there were quite a number of axe murders, especially if they happened to live anywhere near a railroad. All righty. Is there anything else? When Charles Dickens spoke in 1867 in New York City, the line to get in to see him stretched over a mile. In 1914, Austrian troops occupy Belgrade, Serbia. In 1921, the first successful helium dirigible, the C-7, makes a test flight in Portsmouth, Virginia. In 1944, General Patton's troops enter the Saar Valley and break through the Siegfried Line. In 1964, Brazil sends Juan Perón back to Spain, following his efforts to return to his native land. 1970, U.S. Senate votes to give 48,000 acres in New Mexico back to the Taos Indians. Of course, they didn't pay any attention to the rights of those who lived there, but, you know, why should they? They're the elected nobility of this country. Well, we have been talking about all kinds of things. Monsters, scams. Let's talk about serial killers. Serial killers are actually a lot different from regular murderers. Most people commit murder due to some out of passion or anger or even greed. When homicide cops investigate, they usually look at family members as suspects first. Now, there are, of course, people who plan a murder for financial or some other gain, but murder is most often a crime of passion. Serial killers, though, are quite different. They kill a lot of folks, almost all of whom are usually strangers over a period of time, and usually with some sort of cooling-off period between the killings. According to the FBI, a serial killer is somebody who's killed a minimum of 3 people. And that's probably a true definition. We'd also believe in the put into the serial killer category those killers who were stopped from murdering before they reached 3 because they were caught or otherwise incapacitated. The Canadian Paul Bernardo and his masochistic lover Carla Homolka are examples of serial killers. They killed 3 people, but as one of the murders was legally categorized as manslaughter, they weren't, for lack of a better term, official serial killers, because only 2 of their killings are considered first-degree murder. But if you take a close look at the murderous drive inside these 2, a drive that facilitated the rape and murder of young girls, including Carla's own younger sister, there's no way they would have stopped killing if they hadn't been caught. I mean, to get an idea of the mindset, let's look at a quote from Carl Panzram. He said, he was a serial killer. He said, in my lifetime, I've murdered 21 human beings. I've committed thousands of burglaries, robberies, larcenies, arsons, and last but not least, I've committed sodomy on 1,000 male human beings. And for all these things, I'm not the least bit sorry. He was sorry he got caught, though. So at this point, we have to ask, what creates a serial killer? Why is this compulsion? And frankly, it is a compulsion to kill multiple times is created. Some people think the compulsion to kill may be the result of trauma to the brain. That's what Tampa, Florida serial killer Bobby Joe Long thought drove him to rape and murder women. He claimed that before a motorcycle accident caused severe head trauma, he never thought about killing women. Some psychiatrists think it's genetic. An aberration of some sort occurs and puts people on a homicidal path. Another potential reason is that something dreadful happened to the human psyche when a child is shipped to an orphanage or given up to the foster care system. According to author John Bowlby, in his book, The Making and Breaking of Affectional Bonds, and psychopaths, the incidence of illegitimacy and the shunning of the children from one home to another is high. And it was no accident that quite often serial killers do have disrupted childhoods. Now, most psychiatrists are usually vague about exactly what compels somebody to kill. And it's true there's no definitive answer. But most doctors believe that serial killers are programmed in their childhood to be killers. And it's not just doctors that feel that. Most investigators who are close to these crimes and criminals agree, people like the FBI's John Douglas and Robert Ressler, premier profilers and investigators have been investigating serial killers since the term was coined in the 70s. To understand the why of serial killers, one thing has to one first has to accept the existence of the unconscious mind. That things are going on in it constantly, and it's capable of controlling behavior. When a child is abused in one way or another by parents, the anger and terror he or she feels is hidden in the unconscious. This becomes like a seething cauldron, so to speak. The child starts looking for ways to deal with that terrifying feelings that come out of it. Someone in the family, usually the mother or father, has clearly shown the child that he or she has no value except perhaps as a sex object or somebody to hurt. And a terrible fear builds up in the child's unconscious that results in from feeling constantly under threat, so the child starts to formulate fantasies of being all-powerful, controlling and able to handle whatever comes his or her way. And then the child creates symbolic scenarios in which he or she is dominant and acts out, first by showing mastery over animals by abusing them, and sometimes over structures by burning them down. This manifests in adulthood as a powerful sex drive and the abuse of the women or children in the person's life. One of the quotes from Dr. Michael Swango, "I love the sweet, husky, close smell of indoor homicide. The only way I have of reminding myself I'm still alive." And frankly, when all else is taken away, there is that. Now, while all of us are subject to some stress in our childhoods from our parents, the stress we're talking about here is horrendous, and the reaction of the child is equally so. Indeed, in any write-up of serial killers, you'll find reports of horrendous things that happen to children that went on to become serial killers. Ken Biachi's mother, who was a prostitute, held his hand over a stove flame to punish him. Edmund Kemper's parents made him kill his pet chicken and forced him to eat it. These things have an impact. At some point in serial killer development, usually when they're in their 20s, the fantasies of the cruelty to animals is no longer enough to satisfy their murderous rages. Their compulsion is satisfied by nothing less than killing people. And it's been a belief that serial killers are unconsciously terrified of and furious with people because of their own childhoods, and they kill to temporarily alleviate the terror. You know, as with all murderers, you're more male serial killers than female ones. And while it may appear on the surface that some women kill for financial gain, those characterized as black widows who benefit from the killing of family or friends, it's likely the real reasons they kill are the same as they are for men. To take control, to gain power, and to temporarily conquer the terror inside them. And temporarily is a key consideration. You know, between killings, some serial killers need something to remind themselves of how powerful they are. Many keep some personal item of the victim as a trophy of the kill. Investigators refer to that as tokenism. This can be a wallet or a necklace or a driver's license or a shoe or some other object. And the killer handles it when alone to relive the killing and reassert their mastery over the victim. And with this tokenism usually goes masturbation, because it brings the power and satisfaction of the kill back to the murderer. Now, some serial killers go a step further and they take body parts as trophies. Jerry Brudos, a serial killer who operated around Salem, Oregon, cut off one victim's feet, mounted him on a base, and kept him on his mantle as a constant reminder of how powerful he was. Edmund Kemper took the head of one of his female victims, used it as an aid in the shower. Ted Bundy took heads back to his apartment and masturbated on them. You know, some serial killers empowered themselves by becoming cannibals. Albert Fish in the 20s did with a 10-year-old girl he had abducted. And the consumption of human flesh has the same meaning for serial killers as it has for centuries to cannibals in the jungles of South America. They orally incorporate the powers of the victim via cannibalism, or at least that's their belief. And like all insecure people, serial killers are egotist. They want to be known and praise for their achievements as killing machines. You know, serial killers don't emerge suddenly. They don't. Somebody just doesn't get up one morning and say, "I'm a serial killer." They develop. And there may well be indications that a young person is heading that way. A number of years ago, psychiatrists established that a serial murderer will have exhibited one or more specific behaviors in childhood. Cruelty to animals, setting fires, maybe wetting the bed. And if you know a child who exhibits two of these symptoms, you should take them straight to a psychiatrist, for all the good that will do. In particular, cruelty to animals and setting fires are indications of somebody on a power trip. Now, a lot of folks confuse the term mass murderer with serial murderer, but they're quite different. In a mass murder, a group of people is killed all at once. Serial murder describes the act of killing many people one at a time over a relatively long period of time. An example of a mass murder is the March 30th, 1975 murders in Hamilton, Ohio, when James Rupert shot 11 members of his family. In contrast, look at the serial murderer, John Wayne Gacy, who killed at least 33 young men over a period of 6 years. While the most common type of serial killer is the person who operates individually, there are also killers who act together as a team. In this instance, one is usually dominant, and the other person wants to do anything to please the dominant person. One example of this is the Hillside Strangler, who is actually two people. Ken Bianchi was trying to please his dominant cousin, Angelo Bruno Buono Jr. And while there are two instead of one, they both have the same illness, so to speak. The one might be more violent than the other. That doesn't make the innocent or the submissive partner innocent or healthy, just together, they're just as deadly as any solo killer. And unlike regular murderers, serial killers are sociopaths. Now, sociopaths, according to those who study this, are missing an essential part of what makes a person human: the ability to empathize with the pain and suffering of others. The confession of the stealth-style BTK killer, Dennis Rader, tellingly demonstrates the mind of a sociopath. Now, while he stood in front of a judge describing the most wrenching acts of imaginable, it was clear he cared as much about the lives he took as somebody might care about a discarded napkin. No one showed the sociopaths how to love or care for others when they were young. Now, there's been a number of generalizations about serial killers. You know, the victims of a serial killer generally belong to the same race as the killer, but not always. H.H. Holmes has been said to be the first serial killer in American history. He confessed to the murder of 27 people in a Chicago hotel during an 1893 World's Fair. Now, there are those that say Holmes may well have been Jack the Ripper because he did come from England. Now, according to the FBI, to be classified as a serial killer, you have to have killed at least three. And most serial killers don't have any trouble reaching that particular point. There have been conflicting reports as to how extensive serial murder is, but according to the FBI, there may be roughly 70 to 100 serial killers operating at any given time. And interestingly enough, the medical profession has produced the most serial killers, primarily doctors, but nurses have also been in that exclusive club. Now, hands down, Jack the Ripper is considered the most famous serial killer of all time. He slaughtered at least five prostitutes in the Whitechapel area of London. Starting on or about August 31st, 1888, was never apprehended. Now, there's a lot of theories about who he may have been, one of which I mentioned was H.H. Holmes. But there's also evidence to the fact that he may have killed far more than the five that subscribed to him. Now, in the late 1980s, California's San Quentin State Prison was home to four serial killers. William Bonin, Lawrence Bittaker, Randy Kraft, and Douglas Clark. The combined number of victims these four men tortured and murdered is staggering, but every day they'd sit and play bridge, just like many of our grandmothers did with their neighborhood friends. In 1990, Vanity Fair magazine published an article about the men and called them the San Quentin Bridge Club. Well, William Bonin was eventually executed, and that broke up the club. But before his execution, Bonin was kind of feted by others for his achievements. Now, I mentioned earlier a man by the name of Albert Fish. He, not only did he kill, but he liked to torment relatives. And he was one of those known for being practicing cannibalism with his victims. You know, if there is a superstar among serial killers, it might be Albert Fish. And if there's a superstar among detectives chasing serial killers, it might be Will King of the New York Police Department. His pursuit of Albert Fish is the stuff of legends. On May 27, 1928, an ad appeared in the Sunday afternoon edition of the New York World Telegram. It said, "Young man 18 wishes position in the country. Edward Budd, 406 West 15th Street." Well, Albert and Delia Budd had placed the ad for their oldest of their five children, Edward. Family lived in a tiny basement apartment. The idea was that Edward would get a job and send part of his money back to him to help support him. And the next afternoon, there was a knock on the door, and Delia Budd, who was home alone, answered the door. And in the door stood a small man, maybe 5'5", and about 130 pounds, very well dressed in a three-piece navy blue suit, blue shirt, black felt hat, and polished black shoes. Had white hair, watery blue eyes, and Delia guessed he might be in his 60s. He looked like a well-to-do gentleman. She'd later say that the only thing that tarnished the image was his teeth. They were missing, broken, and discolored. She said, in fact, they reminded her of an animal's teeth. Identified himself as Frank Howard and said he was a farmer and had seen Edward's ad and he wanted to talk with him about working on his farm. Well, of course, this excited Delia and she invited him in. And young Edward came in a short time later and he expressed interest in working for the elderly man. And Howard explained to the Buds that he owned a farm in Farmingdale, Long Island, and business had recently picked up to the point needed to hire somebody to help him. And he's willing to pay $15 a week, which was a considerable sum in those days. Well, the Buds were very impressed with Howard, particularly the fact that he appeared to be wealthy. At one point in the conversation, he pulled out a roll of greenbacks that would have choked a horse, and for a family who didn't have much, this was awe-inspiring display of wealth. Well, Howard offered Edward a job, and Edward asked him whether he might have an additional position on the farm for his friend, Willie Corman. Howard said he would, and he promised to return the next Saturday and pick them both up. Well, on the following Saturday, the Buds waited patiently for Howard to pick up Edward and his friend Willie, but Howard didn't show up. That night, they got a telegram from Howard saying he'd unexpectedly had to go to New Jersey on business, and he promised to be there the next day. Now, this time, Howard showed up about 11 o'clock in the morning, well-dressed, ready to take the boys to his Long Island farm. But he got there earlier than they expected him, and so the two boys weren't ready to go. And as Howard and the Buds waited in the living room for the boys to get ready, 10-year-old Grace Budd came into the room. Now, she was a thin, sickly sort of child, according to all descriptions, but on this particular Sunday, she was looking her best. had on a white confirmation dress. Her soft, dark brown hair was bobbed and her blue eyes twinkled. And Howard, of course, gushed at what a beautiful child she was, and Grace took to the old man immediately, walked over and sat on his lap. And Howard took to her, and he engaged her in a game of counting his money. He had $91 in his pocket, an impressive amount. Rewarded her counting ability by giving her a half dollar for candy. Then Howard came up with an idea. His niece was having a birthday party at her home on 137th Street, Columbus Avenue, and he had a few hours before they needed to leave for the farm, so he asked the parents if it might be okay to take Grace to the party. Well, Delia Budd wasn't too thrilled about the idea, but her husband, Albert, thought it was a wonderful idea. How often, he asked, did Grace get the chance to get away from their cellar apartment, so Grace put on a gray coat and left with Howard, said he'd have her back in just a few hours. Well, the Buds accompanied the pair out of the apartment and watched as Grace walked, hand in hand with Howard, toward 9th Avenue. Later, Delia Budd would admit to having an almost subconscious concern about her daughter. She watched them walk away, but she didn't say or do anything. And just before they turned the corner, Grace turned and yelled something, but they couldn't hear what she said. Well, if only the Buds had known a very simple fact, their daughter might have lived. Columbus Avenue ended at 105th Street. The intersection of 137th Street and Columbus did not exist. Well, as you might guess, Howard didn't return with the little girl at the appointed time. The Buds wondered where they might be, and Edward and Willie were anxious to get going to their new jobs. And then the Buds thought maybe Howard and Grace had been in an accident, but amazingly enough, they didn't contact the police about their missing daughter until the next morning. Well, at the time Grace disappeared, the NYPD had recently formed a Missing Persons Bureau, and they sent two detectives to see the Buds and try to determine what had happened. And one of those detectives was a man named Will King. And King was a gruff-talking, heavy smoker who believed in order and discipline, and he lived for being a cop. He was also gutsy, patriotic, and had that most important attribute of a great detective. He was determined. Frank Howard would have been better off if Sherlock Holmes, not Will King, had come to investigate the case. Now, word of what was then regarded as an abduction spread fast, and soon newspaper men were assaulting 406 West 15th Street, swarming all over the Buds for tidbits about Howard and the little girl. And under immense pressure to solve the case, the head of the Missing Persons Bureau assigned 50 detectives, forming a task force with King as the head. People at the time said it was the only case that rivaled in intensity was the kidnapping of Charles Lindbergh's baby. Now, to King, there was little question Grace Budd was dead. But what upset him was that a man could walk in off the street, take a little girl, and never come back. So King pursued that case with a withering ferocity. Detectives spread out and talked to hundreds of people. They dusted the entire house for prints. They questioned Western Union at length about the telegram Howard had sent the Buds. Went to Farmingdale to question farm owners. They followed every possible lead. But after a few months, they came up with nothing. And the task force members are reassigned to new cases. It still remained an open case, but the police department decided they had done all they could do, so they were going to conveniently forget about it. But Will King didn't. Now, he handled other cases, to be sure, but in a mind-boggling display of determination, not a single day went by when he didn't pursue one lead or another in the Budd case. Now, some of the earliest leads came from ordinary people. When the case first hit the media, the Budds were deluged with mail, both sympathetic and crank, from time to time. They'd get letters that seemed to contain actual leads and turn them over to the police. And Will King followed up on each one of these leads. And mail leads continued even after police stopped actively investigating. And King specifically instructed the Buds to turn the mail on Grace over to him unopened, but whenever he got it, it'd be open. And his relationship with the Buds became less than cordial when... While King understood they just wanted to find their daughter, they were contaminating the evidence. Weeks turned to months, then to years, and soon it had been more than 6 years since Grace and Bud had disappeared with the kindly old Mr. Howard, and not a single day had gone by when Will King hadn't worked on that case. In fact, his superiors started to worry about him, and their worry proved to be very well founded. In early 1934, Will King, working night and day on his other case as well as the disappearance of Grace Bud, collapsed and was confined to a hospital for 3 months. Before he was discharged, the doctors warned him about overtaxing himself. The police department, concerned for his health, assigned him to a desk job. But in spite of all that, he didn't stop. He pursued every lead, however thin, that turned up and continued his awe-inspiring pursuit of the kidnapper. Beside the overall frustration not solving the case, it was also the promising leads that didn't pan out. To King, each new lead was a new hope, a new road that would lead him to the kidnapper. And unfortunately for him, each one of them turned out to be a dead end. Then on November 2nd, 1934, Will King got a telephone call from Delia Budd. She'd gotten a letter from somebody, and it looked like it was all about Grace. Did he want to see it? Well, of course he did. Edward Budd brought over the letter, and this one was unopened, and King opened it and read it. And the contents of the letter were later to be read into the court record and would stun and repulse people, but King was excited. It was the handwriting. He didn't have to be a graphologist to know that the spidery-inked handwriting in this letter to Delia Budd is written by the same man who'd written the telegram to the Budd 6 years ago, telling him that his arrival would be delayed because of business in New Jersey. And his name was Frank Howard. In part, the letter read, "On Sunday, June 3rd, 1928, I called on you at 406 West 15th Street. Grace sat in my lap. Made up my mind to eat her on the pretense of taking her to a party. You said she could go, so I took her to an empty house in Westchester and already picked out. When we got there, I told her to remain outside, and she picked wildflowers, and I went upstairs and stripped my clothes off. I knew if I didn't, I'd get blood all over them. When it was ready, I went to the window and called her. Then I hid in the closet until she was in the room. When she saw me all naked, she began to cry and tried to run downstairs, but I grabbed her, and she said she'd tell her mama. And first, I stripped her, and boy, did she kick, bite, and scratch. Then I choked her. Then I cut her into small pieces so I could take my meat to my rooms, cook it, and eat it. It took me 9 days to eat her entire body. Well, what followed was a masterpiece of detective work on the part of Will King. He noticed a legal-sized envelope the letter arrived in had an emblem and some initials on it, and that somebody had attempted to scratch him out. And by holding the envelope up to the light, he could read them clearly enough. NYPCBA. Well, a check of the phone book revealed that NYPCBA stood for the New York Private Chauffeurs Benevolent Association, located at 627 Lexington Avenue in New York. King went to the headquarters and explained his business to the president of the association. And the president was concerned that King suspected one of his members, but King assured him that he just wanted to check handwriting samples. It took him more than 7 hours to do it, worked well past midnight, but King checked the handwriting samples on applications for membership in the organization. None was close to the handwriting of Frank Howard. So King tried another tactic. A few days after reviewing the applications, he spoke in front of the 75-member group and asked whether anybody had used any of the NYPCBA envelopes or taken any for personal use. He made it clear nobody would get in trouble if they had, but he was vague as to why he wanted to know. After his speech, he waited in the president's office until a small red-haired man named Leo Sikorsky came in. After being assured by King there would be no punishment, Sikorsky admitted he'd taken some of the envelopes and used them while he lived at a rooming house at 622 Lexington, and he said he might have left some of them there. King immediately went to the rooming house, but he was disappointed again. Nobody had rented Sikorsky's room since he left it. In fact, it was boarded up tight, and the canvas of the neighborhood proved fruitless. Nobody knew anybody who looked like Frank Howard. Well, stymied, King went back to Sikorsky to find out whether he remembered anything else, and Sikorsky said before 622 Lexington he had lived at 200 East 52nd Street, and he'd left some of the envelopes on a shelf behind a bed. Well, King went over there, and it was a flop house, and this time he found something. Spoke with the landlady and asked her whether she knew anybody who looked like Howard, and she did. Said it looked like Albert Fish, who was staying in number 7. King looked at the signature on the register, and there's no doubt in his mind Albert Fish and Frank Howard were the same man. King asked where Fish was, and the woman didn't know, but says he periodically returned to the flop house to pick up a check from the Civilian Conservation Corps sent by his son John. King checked it all out, and then he set up a stakeout. Taking a room at the top of the stairs, it gave him a view of the intersection of 52nd and 3rd. He smoked, he exercised, he ate canned food, but he stayed awake more than 20 hours a day. Unfortunately, Fish didn't show up. Then on December 12, 1934, King decided to take a break from his routine and went Christmas shopping. He was away for 2 hours. As soon as he returned to his room, there was a rapid-fire knocking on the door, and it was the landlady. She told him Fish was back. He'd come by a half hour ago and told him his check wasn't in, even though it was. He was waiting. She didn't know how long he'd stay. So King strapped on his .38, went to Fish's room and knocked, and the person inside invited him in. And sitting on the bed was a man who perfectly fit the description of Frank Howard. Little white-haired, baggy-eyed man with watery blue eyes. King identified himself as a policeman and told Fish he wanted to talk to him about some letters he'd written. And Fish needed to come with him to headquarters, and Fish agreed. Well, King brought him downstairs, and then just as they were about to exit the building, Fish whirled, straight razors in both hands. King subdued him and put the cuffs on him. He had actually seen a glimpse of the real Albert Fish. He was a dangerous man. The police station, for whatever reason, Fish started to speak. He expounded on the horrendous letter for the detectives. Said that after he killed Grace, he positioned her neck on a 1 gallon paint pail and cut her head off, letting her blood drip into the pail. He tried to drink the warm blood, but he vomited it up, he said. Then he used a knife and a cleaver to cut her in half at the navel, and then he proceeded to cut her into small pieces. He planned on eating all of her except her head, guts, and skeleton. And it was all true. Later at his trial, he admitted that as he ate Grace Budd over the 9 days specified in the letter, he was in a state of continual sexual excitement. And the memory of eating her during the day led him to what many people refer to as physical abuse at night. Ultimately, Fish led the police to the house where Grace's murder had occurred. The abandoned Wisteria Cottage, as the locals called it, in Greenburg, New York. He showed detectives where he'd buried the parts he didn't eat, and they used pickaxes and shovels to break through the frozen ground till they found Grace's head and the various bones. Now, there was some jurisdictional dispute before this case ended, but Fish was eventually tried for the murder of Grace Budd in White Plains, New York. The trial lasted 9 days in March of 1934, and then he was convicted of her abduction and murder and sentenced to death in the electric chair. He described the upcoming death
motion detected at the front door
as a supreme thrill of his life. Apparently, for a sadomasochistic psychopath, he thought of being electrocuted was quite enticing. And the trial produced some interesting background on Albert Fish. He had some very quaint habits. Engaged in eating human waste, he liked to stick needles into himself, and on one occasion, he tried to stick needles into his testicles, but had to stop. It was too painful, he said. When doctors took x-rays of Fish at Sing Sing, they found numerous long pins been driven into his abdomen as a kind of gruesome acupuncture. Technically, doing such a thing is known as a piquet act, jabbing sharp objects into yourself or others for sexual gratification. And on the day Fish was to be electrocuted, which was January 16, 1936, three of his six children visited him. Less than a year after his trial, Albert Fish had his last meal at 11 p.m. that night. His children were there when the switch was thrown. Said it took two full jolts to kill him because all the needles and pins he'd stuck into his body. Well, King knew that Fish, who'd roamed the country as an itinerant house painter, had killed other children. In fact, a number of children disappeared from neighborhoods where Fish had been working. However, Fish never officially confessed to any other killings except the murder of Grace Budd, which was enough to send him to the electric chair. Well, Albert Fish was pretty much doomed to a life of crime and sadism from the start. Born May 19, 1870 in Washington, D.C. When he was 5 years old, his 75-year-old father died in New York's old Penn Station, leaving his mother, who in a striking age difference from her husband was just in her early 40s, to take care of little Albert. And she couldn't afford to support herself, so she had no choice but to put Albert in St. John's Orphanage in Washington, D.C. When he was 9 years old, his mother was a little more stable and able to take care of him, so she took him home. But the orphanage had been a training ground for Fish in the perverse, sexually, and every other way. And, of course, because of his psychological makeup, Fish is ready to use whatever he'd learned. Well, in an author by the name of Harold Schechter wrote a book called Deranged, and in it he listed the peculiar obsessions of Albert Fish. He said there were 15 of them, including undinism, a sexual preoccupation with one's own urine, and the only thing that seemed to be missing from Fish's list is bestiality. However, with someone like this, you just don't know. Well, then we have Bobby Joe Long. Now, the sexual drive of Bobby Joe Long can be described in one word: absolutely unbelievable. And for a number of women in Florida, it became all too believable and deadly. Now, Bobby Joe believed his troubles began in 1974 when he was involved in a very nasty motorcycle accident, speeding down a street in Tampa, Florida, when a car suddenly appeared in front of him. He slammed on the brakes, but it didn't help. He was thrown into the car hard enough to crack his motorcycle helmet. And from then on, Bobby Joe says, strange things happened to his sex drive. In fact, he said all he could think about was sex. And to do it all the time, becoming almost satyr-like. Before the accident occurred, he'd have sex with his slim, pretty wife, Cindy Jean, two or three times a week. After the accident, they'd have it two or three times a day. Now, this type of sex drive is reminiscent of Albert DeSalvo, who claimed to be the Boston Strangler. You know, soon enough, sex with his wife wasn't enough for Bobby Joe. He wanted other women as well. Starting in 1980, Bobby Joe started to look at the want ads in the Miami and Ocala areas of Florida. He'd find ads for furniture or televisions for sale, and during the day, and it was always during the day, it was less likely that a man would be home, he'd go to the home to look at the item for sale. Once he was inside and sure that nobody else was there, he'd tie and gag the woman, and then he'd rape them. He said he did this more than 50 times between 1980 and 1983. He became known in the area as the want-ad rapist. Local task force and the FBI went after him, but he eluded them with ease. As the rapes continued, he felt a rising sense of anger. He started to feel anger as never before. The slightest thing would trigger a towering rage, which he would act out in bizarre ways. One, for example, his wife, his mother, Luella, was visiting and said something that displeased him. He grabbed her and spanked her like a child. An absurd, painful, and humiliating event for her. And noise started to bother him. Slightest noise would set off an explosive reaction. Now, we're going to talk more about Bobby Joe, but for today, we've come to the end of the show. So until tomorrow at the same time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.